It's been enjoyable being here. There's nothing like coming to a place, though, and meeting old friends. And two of my former students are now a PhD student here now. And they've got two kids and one kid on the way. One on the way. Now, that just goes to show you that Golden Gate's very fertile. We got that started there. And so always knew he had it in him. I want to thank you for having me. I have been lecturing, and we're going to still be feeding you and kind of moving out, so please don't be distracted. But I've been lecturing on multicultural, intercultural ministry, and have been spending most of my time dealing with the cities and the wave of the growth in our urban areas and how to do ministry there. And I thought what I would do is I would take a switch, because I knew there would be several faculty members here, as well as doctoral students and other students, and see if I couldn't at least stimulate you to think about multiculturalism in four basic areas. Well, really five. And that would be teaching in the classroom, in our preaching, in our counseling, in leadership. That's four. All right. And so I'd like to kind of give you some of the things that I've learned that have helped me to be much more multicultural. Does this exclude not knowing something about various different large people groups like Asians, African Americans, Hispanics? No, I think that it helps us as ministers, as instructors, to know history of a people, know where they've come from, know if there are any particular learning styles. There's a book out by the Breckenridges called What Color's Your God? And in that book, they attempt to make a case for understanding race as a learning style. And I'm very much against that. It is just too racist. I don't believe there's any one group or subgroup where you can typecast that they all learn in one particular way. And so I don't buy that. But if you're interested in looking at that from not just a cultural perspective or a multicultural perspective, but from a race perspective, they have done some homework in this area and do offer some things. Now, I'm not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are some things that I have learned, for example, where it comes to race and culture, which is very, very true. For example, most of the Anglos and the African Americans, they tend to like confrontation. They tend to like dialogue. They tend to like debate. They tend to like the fight. The Asian students, the majority of them that I have, especially if they've not been here in the United States for a long time, they tend to be much more quieter. And so you cannot judge if learning is taking place by their inclusion in the debate or in the group work. As a matter of fact, group work tends to be the worst style of learning for many of the Asian groups, especially the Koreans who have just come over, at least as we have observed in the classroom. So you can't evaluate so much in that way, but it is something to be aware of. And also, too, the issue of shame. You almost can't shame an African-American and an Anglo. I mean, again, they love debate, they love conflict, they love to dialogue. But in some of our other cultures, I've found this in just about all of the Asian cultures, Japanese, Chinese, and Korean, that if there is a possibility of shame, they're going to shut down on you. And there may even be some personal problems that need to be dealt with that you need to be aware of. So let's kind of start off with instruction. When we talk about instruction or multicultural education as it has been presented from a secular perspective, we've seen the notion of changing pictures. When I was in school, most of the pictures in the book were of Anglo culture. Most of the pictures that were in the environment were of Anglo culture. Most of the pictures that were used to sort of acclimate us to whatever the study was tended to be much more Anglo-centric. Now we're seeing some differences there. Teachers are getting diverse education. There are special emphasis days. I know that even now in many of our churches, you don't have to be black to celebrate Martin Luther King. I asked the class earlier today, do you celebrate that day at all in your churches? And nobody said, yes, he was a great Christian. He was a great Baptist. And so there are some other cultural perspectives that can be brought into the classroom as positive for learning. And when students don't ever hear about people from their particular group as doing something positive or making a contribution to a body of work or discipline of study, there is a tendency to feel as if I am not as much worth, or I am not at least appreciated. I thought for a long time in foreign missions, because I tended to see Anglos always going to Africa or always going to some other people group that we never went. And so I'd encourage anybody to go, because obviously that's not something that we were supposed to do, and how wrong I was. Strategies for assimilation. How do you come? You know, people like myself and Dr. Walker came into the academic system of Golden Gate and Southern by way, so to speak, of assimilation. What I mean by that is that we came out of the radical times of the 60s and the early 70s, but this institution is not very much changed by radical input. In other words, one has to get inside to bring about change. We shared some of those things tonight, and both of us have seen some good change. Would we call it a great deal of change? No, not a great deal of change, but certainly some change has taken place. Why is that? Because we've learned how to work with the system, and I do believe that you will find that just about throughout what we call the Southern Baptist Convention, if that is your desire to work within that group, that it is a group that works better from the inside in terms of bringing about change, and so we have seen that. Strategies for revolution. Well, we've not talked very much about that in our area, but in some secular areas, especially in the area of institutional racism, there is a lot that is going on where there is teaching about how to change systems in a very fast way. I believe that for us as in ministry, that there are some other things that we can do, and especially just starting out at the lowest level. And this is more subculture than it is culture. But three things that have changed my whole instruction technique, and that is to remember that there are at least three subcultures in every one of my classes. And that is my hearers, my seers, and my doers. And so when I am, all of teaching is an activity. Even right now, what I'm doing, that's an activity. And so if we're just lecturing, which is basically the culture that I grew up in, that's a hearing culture that you'll hit. But you won't hit the hearers and the seers and the doers. Those are subcultures. And today, my children in their school, if you don't have visuals, if you don't have video, you can forget about them almost learning anything. So in terms of instruction for us today, there's not a class that I don't think about at least these three types of subcultures. Now, why do I give you that? I believe that this is the basic level, not race, but this is the basic sub-level for reaching across cultures. It doesn't matter if you're in China, if you're in Africa, if you're in America, doesn't matter where it is, you're going to have hearers, you're going to have seers, and you're going to have doers. Activities that reach all three of these tend to at least get you started in multicultural education. These are subcultures. People who are, what I mean by that is they are more directed in those particular areas. The second is the questions. There are at least four question raisers in every class. And these also represent a culture. You have students who ask the question, why do I need to know this? Until that question is answered, they don't learn very much. The why people want to know, why is this important? Why do I need to know this? You have them out in your congregation. And when you go to preach, And you have to be asking yourself, I've got these folks that they want to know right up front, why do I need to hear this from you? Then you have the folk who want to know, okay, we've got this big body of information, and I believe that it's important. What do I need to know? Give me what it is that is most important for me to do the job that I need to do. And then third, which is the group that I come out of, my learning style is, how can I use this? That's the question that's on the top of my head. How can I use this? I want to go and apply it right away. And then the fourth one is, what else can I do with this? Your innovators, they want to know, how can I be creative with this? What new things that have not been attempted? What are the new possibilities? So I have to leave some time at the end of my classes, at least at the end of the semester, to raise this question. What did you not get that you think you should have got? And what else can we possibly do with this class, with this material, to reach the next group? If I'm going to be effective, I've got to touch these four questions. What do I need to know? Why do I need to know this? How can I use this? What else can I do? We're talking now about structuring the activity, which is the teaching process. That is the heart of teaching, your activity. That's your vehicle for getting your information across. These four subcultures are in every classroom. I've also learned that just making my bibliography multicultural, adding people to the bibliography that it may not be that I have a primary textbook that is of an ethnic person. I do try to use a variety of textbook. You can't all the time do that, but you can at least have a bibliography that says there is somebody who is doing something in these areas, and also, too, you'll get another perspective. And so I added that to the teaching questions instruction, too. Instruction three, stimuli, I need to be concerned about social relations. Some people learn better culture in groups. Some people learn better in lecture. Again, I mentioned earlier, my Asian students tend, especially Koreans, tend to do better with the lecture. When I put them in group learning, the learning goes down because, from their culture, they are not great talkers, at least those who were not born here. So I need to know that, because when I create an activity that does not take that into consideration, then that is going to affect the learning of that student. Environmental, just how that classroom is set up will encourage dialogue, or is better for some students, not just the regular standard method, the lighting and so forth. The type of seats. We've gone to a much more comfortable seating, more adult environment for our classrooms. It has done wonders in terms of the learning process. Give a couple more. There's psychological, physiological concerns, and emotional concerns. The book, the text that most of this comes out of is a book by Marlene Lefevre. She's a woman who works for the Cook Publishing Company and has done some extensive study here, and you probably need to go a little bit further than what I'm doing. But also, too, there is a professor in St. John's University that has done sort of the basic research in this area, and her name is Rita. It escaped me. It'll come in just a moment. But that's where most of the work that is in Marlene Lefevre's book, Learning Styles, comes off of that professor's work out of St. John. Okay, what about preaching? How can we look a little bit about instruction. What can we do with our preaching to make it more multicultural? I preach to a church where there are about 60% Anglos, about 20% African-American, about 20% Asian, about 10% Hispanic. I come out of an African-American tradition. For the first couple of months in that church, I flunked. And I flunked because I was preaching sermons I wanted to hear. I liked to sing. I was singing songs I wanted to hear. And I was losing. I was losing our people. I was losing our market. And somebody told me, which was very insightful, why don't you preach sermons that we'd like to hear? Why don't you sing some songs that are akin to where we're coming from? I said, you know what? You're right. And so now when I do a sermon, I ask myself this question. I mean, you should always ask yourself the question about who you're speaking to, but I ask myself this question, what does Han Chang, how does this sound to Han Chang? How does this sound to Maria? How does this sound to Lisa? How does this sound to Mattie Lou Jeffries, who's 102? You know, I ask myself that question because I know I have a tendency, just like in teaching, to teach the style I like to learn from best. Same thing with preaching. I like to preach the style that I like to hear best, but that's not the crowd that I'm preaching to. All right. Remember, preaching is not all of worship. It is a part of the symphony. In some of our traditions, preaching is held high, and the preacher is held to the highest. And preaching is not worship. It's not all of worship. It is a part of worship. And I think that when you take that attitude, you'll bring the other folk into the process, and they will feel their importance in this whole thing. Ask not only what the text is saying, but what are the people doing? You know, so much about preaching and even teaching, again, too, is related to what is that text saying? Well, if we're going to be cultural, multicultural, we have to ask what are the people doing? What are the people about? What are their lifestyles about? What are they eating? What are they wearing if they refer to that? Even that right there can help us to be a little bit more multicultural in seeking the word. Seek the vertical and the horizontal. You know, we're dealing with, of course, our relationship with God, but the horizontal, we must be concerned with our brothers and sisters who we are seeking to reach and also to raise up. Okay, after seeking the word, we got to structure that word. Exegesis, definition, and explanation. There is so much about the culture of that time, and the Bible isn't just one culture. It is multicultural, and it takes in a lot of different cultures. So when we do our exegesis, which is generally our first part of our structuring, our first part of our preaching, to deal with the culture that's going on there. By exegesis, we mean, again, definition and explanation. Illustration, you know, taking it from the then to the now. The now calls for an illustration of what's the transition, what is the bridge from what's happening then to what's, I understand the culture there now, but how do you relate that to what's going on now? There has to be some kind of bridge that takes us from then to now. If you just stay in the then, even if you're multicultural, all that you are doing is giving a nice Bible study. I must get into the now so that people's lives can be changed. Application, personal, specific, and positive. I guarantee you, if you're personal, you're going to hit where a person is, what their cultural background is, what their thinking is, and so forth. And I say there, be positive and be specific. What do I mean by being specific? All of culture has what I call a bias. And a bias is just simply, if you look at a diamond ring, you notice it has several cuts that are symmetrical. All of them are the same size. And that's because the gem cutter has a skill of cutting that diamond on that edge every time. Well, in preaching, we also have a bias, and that is the word of God. And it should cut across that person's life, not where I am, but where they are. That is the specificity of that. That's two things that's got to be known there. Number one, I've got to know you. I've got to spend some time in relationship building. And also, too, I have to have a great confidence that even where I fall short, that God is concerned about where you are in your particular situation. All right, now saying the word. In saying the word, there are two areas I think that we can improve our multicultural preaching style. That is, number one, in our nonverbal, our gestures. Some gestures are not appropriate in certain cultures, and I need not say very much there. Eye contact, there are some cultures where, and even your students, when they're asked to do presentations, they may not have eye contact because in that culture, eye contact is not seen as being something that you do. In our culture, you are taught from a very young person. You look at that person. You look them straight in the eye, and you tell them what you want. Well, everybody's not like that. That's where we're from. And dress. You know, here at Southern, and we used to be, I noticed that there is a pretty strong formality, and that is shirts and ties and suits. In California culture, we seldom wear suits at school. Our deans don't even wear suits. Our president oftentimes will not wear a suit and a tie. But that is appropriate for that culture. All that I'm saying is that your nonverbal stuff also says a lot for you in terms of reaching people. I would just simply say this, that appropriate does not mean dirty. Even when I'm talking to kids, you know, let it be clean. I may have a rip or two in my blue jeans, but they're going to be clean, I guarantee you. The second item here is verbal. In certain cultures, we talk very fast. We might even have a little rhythm to it. In other cultures, people talk so slow. It's like water torture. But here again, making that adjustment. Pitch. There are some parts of the country where they have what I call the holy wines. And if you in Arkansas, it may sound something like this. And the Lord God said, down by the river. And if you were in some of the southern states or in traditional African American, it might be, oh, Lord. And you know, here again, it's funny to you. But there are, in those cultures, if it's not done, you haven't preached. We could go a little bit further here and talk about length and all of this. And I am told that you are out of here at 12:30. And keep going? All right. Okay. He said keep going a little bit. Is this helping you? All right. So we've talked about instruction, teaching. We've talked about preaching, how we can become a little bit more multicultural. Just a word about worship. Let us remember, Moses took his shoes off. That was worship. Miriam sang, Isaiah cried, David danced. You know, there is no one style of worship, and you may be set in a culture where worship is not in by 11 and out by 12, three hymns, preaching, and then, you know, you're out of there. And the key thing here is to, on that people group's turf, to meet them and design. Ask yourself the question. Some of you going into church planning was in that class earlier today. What would worship look like to these people? Not what would worship look like to me or what would it sound like to me, because if I was designing it for me, it would have some of that other stuff I've just demonstrated for you. But what would it look like for them? What would be most appropriate for Maria? What would be most appropriate for Han Chang? You know, these are the questions you'd have to ask. And I don't believe, I think the content of worship, especially our language and also to our theology is very important, but our behavior, it's not so. Just to tell you a little bit of something, I mentioned this in Dr. Terry's class earlier, and that is that in this church where I am right now, we went through a big thing. You know, now it's all right to clap. African Americans have been clapping a long time and raising hands. But in Southern Baptist, just 15 years ago, that was considered to be charismatic, and that's something you didn't do. So when we first, all of these different groups started coming into our church, and they brought some of those traditions with them, the clapping and raising of hands, I thought we were going to have a clapping section and a hand-raising section, so that when folk came in, we'd say, which section would you like, clapping or non-clapping? You know, we've kind of got past that, and we're doing all right. All right, counseling. What are some of the things? There are five cross-cultural questions that in pastoral care that I've learned that are cross-cultural, that all of human beings, if you are a human, then you are dealing with these questions. I would also say that in teaching and in preaching, these five questions are also relevant, but I've seen them primarily in my counseling area. And that is, number one, you have a subculture of people who are discovering who am I, identity. They're wrestling with that. Some of you in here who are students, you are wrestling with that. What area of ministry do I need to be going into? Where is God calling me? I want to be open to that. So who am I? Number two, where did I come from? Do you know that there's not an educational institution nor discipline from medicine to law to religion, you name it, that is not dealing with this question right now, every day and in every classroom? And most of them are giving information that deals with evolution or some other form or way that we got here other than that first chapter and first verse of Genesis, in the beginning, God created. Let me tell you what, there are people that are sitting in our pews. There are people who are in our classroom that have not dealt with this issue. And so they're there. Why am I here? Purpose. You know, what am I supposed to be doing? Well, you know, I've got all of this stuff I'm understanding. Who am I? Where did I come from? Why am I here? That culture's out there. What can I do? Potential. Okay, I know what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be reaching people for Jesus Christ. That is my purpose. I'm supposed to be growing up people for Jesus Christ. But in actuality, what is my potential for doing it? Who would want me? There are still churches that won't want you if you're a certain color. There are still churches that won't want you. There are still some institutions that will not want you because that you are a woman. That is a legitimate subcultural question for these individuals. What can I do? You don't want me over there, or I can't be over here. What then can I do? Where can I serve? Where can I be of use? And then lastly, where am I going? Destiny. Well, I say like Ezekiel in the dry bones, 37, I'm bound for the promised land. All right. Okay, I'm going to stop there because I want to give us some time for questions. Okay? All right, I'm gonna stop right there. There's a little more that we have to do, but in terms of time, what I've been doing is doing a lot of chatting in the classes and not giving enough time for question raising. And you're not going to be multicultural overnight, but I guarantee you, if you practice some of this, you will at least begin on the journey. So I'm going to shut up a minute. Any questions? Yes, sir.
In your several learning styles, I'm interested to know what your observation has been as far as cross-cultural implications of Cole style of the Hebrew promotion and that type of thing. Does it fit multiculturally, or is it really set just for the thing?
No, it fits multiculturally without a doubt. Again, Lefevre's work came off of that prof at St. Coldsword, K-O-L-B. It doesn't matter what culture you're in. You're going to have seers, you're going to have hearers, and you're going to have people who do. That is going to be much more important than if, in fact, you know me as an African-American. Now, I didn't say it's not important that you know me, but it's going to be more important that you have some idea of the various learning styles. And for many, I've got classrooms with 25, 30 students in there. I can't remember all of that, but I can do this, that when I am setting up a lesson plan, I'm going to have at least three activities for every learning objective that deals with hearing, seeing, and doing. All right, in doing multicultural ministry, which generally takes place in cities, because that's where the majority of your diversity has gone, the traditional methods, the traditional programs tend not to be effective. The knocking on doors in California, they won't even let you in your door. You know, you go out there and they may even have you locked up. But creative methods do work well. What are some of those methods? Night ministry. Many people work now around the clock, or they've got both parents working at night. You got teenagers at home. These are big gang areas because in the cities and so forth. Night ministry, night basketball, this type thing, seems to look pretty good in that kind of setting. We have a language school. We started off teaching Chinese a year and a half ago. We started off teaching Chinese with 7 students. The reason for that is we had learned that most of the Chinese were second, third generation, and they did not know the language of their people, Mandarin and Cantonese. And so what we did was we started teaching. I should have asked somebody. We started teaching the language to the children. Why is that? Because their primary language now was English. They didn't know their own language. And we had people there, because we're multicultural, who could teach them their language. That thing flowered so much. We had to start a Japanese school. We had to start a Korean school. We went from 7 to over 100, almost like that. And a part of that was not just the young people that we were teaching. Asian parents will go anywhere their kids go. You know, in America, we send our kids. But Asian parents, they go and they're with their kids, and they will pay almost any amount of money to see that their kid gets whatever it is educationally that they need to get. And so they wanted those students to have those language classes, but they also, too, have joined those language classes, some of them the ESL class that we had to start. English as a second language for some of them. So we have this big language school, which is one of our largest evangelistic vehicles for reaching that community. Again, we're the largest Asian church in our community. We're the largest African-American church in our community. And there are some things that we're doing that are particular to that. Example, we changed some of our music, especially in our youth ministry area. We went from some of the more traditional stuff. The music of today for many youth, and especially African-American youth, is rap. But we are getting a lot of other youth that are not akin to the classical stuff. We don't change the lyrics. We don't change the lyrics. We don't change the words. We still talk about Jesus. We still talk about the things that are particular to our doctrine and to our theology, but what we change is the music. There is no sacred music. They flock to that. They flock to that because that's the beat that they step to. We ran about 7 kids in our youth ministry for years using traditional programs. We went to a program called Awana, Approved Workmen Are Not Ashamed, and they had a division where they had the T-shirts that were hip-hop and some of this kind of stuff. We went from 7 to 300. We run 300 kids a week, Thursday. When I'm talking about Sunday school, we're just talking about Wednesday and Thursday ministry. Many of those churches right around us are not reaching any. Why? Just that simple change, a cultural thinking. Instead of doing ministry from what I would like or what my culture was or what I am inclined to be, to what is the needs of the people that are out there. Yes, sir. Our missions professor. I think, first of all, don't do what so many have done, and that is to look for quick change overnight. Because all that's going to do is going to kill what you have. And I would say this, every church is not going to be multi-ethnic. Even in the city, it's not going to be. There's still going to be room for African-American churches, Anglo churches, Chinese, Korean, Japanese churches. There's still going to be a place for those individuals. But we must learn multicultural skills. Some of these skills are what we are beginning to see in many Anglo churches. We're calling contemporary church, which seems to be sort of a mid-ground for all of these groups to come into. You cannot do that overnight in a traditional church unless you want to kill it. And I would say this, something is better than nothing. Yeah, matter of fact, let me get you to repeat that. Something is better than nothing. I've seen some folk that have done some, and I'm just going to say, some real dumb things in terms of trying to get there. It's a slow process. And I do believe this, that if you take your time in loving people and getting them to see that that whole work that you're doing is evangelistic, that whole, everything that God's doing, he never got off of missions. He's been on missions from the very beginning, and he is still on missions. The whole church taking the whole gospel to the whole world. He's never changed from that. And he just wants us to get on his program. I think that if you love them into it, you will discover that folk will give up their selfishness. And let me say something, because I don't want you to leave out of here with this. I am not talking about white Southern Baptists only. Some of the greatest preservers of culture are African American churches. And what I mean by that is we came out of slavery. Many of our conventions that were started were in backlash to slavery and Jim Crowism. And so we have made our culture equal with our faith. In other words, blackness and faith, kente cloth and Jesus cloth, same thing. No, not the same thing. Not the same thing. I am not saying that you have to give up your culture, but you do have to be willing to share your culture. If you are not willing to share your culture and to share your power with other people, you'll never be multicultural. You can forget it. You know. And so again, I made that mention about African Americans because I find it easier talking to Anglos about being multicultural than I do most African Americans and most Asians, especially Koreans. We tend to be very similar in terms of our ethnocentricity. You know, we love Jesus, but we also love blackness. And they're both on the same level. That's not biblical. And if I can reach some people by not being as overtly one thing, I'm not saying that I should push myself into oblivion, but in order to reach some people, which means that I've got to change some things, it takes a great deal of unselfishness, but it should be done. Prophet, let me see if there's anybody else, and I'll come back to you. This way we won't be that we've not given it, at least everybody who wanted a chance to speak a chance to say something. Okay. We have 13 people on our staff. When I went there, we had 3 people on the staff, myself, our receptionist, and the janitor, and we now have, and we've grown, you know, quite a bit from 278 to a little over 1,000. Our staff is made up of the diversity of the church. So you have Hispanic, we have Anglos. Our administrator is a woman, and she is the top I've seen out, and I hope that we'll go further with that in terms of other ministries. So we do have we are representative. We just lost our Asian pastor. Do you remember George Lim that taught in our area? George got called, he's Chinese pastor, he got called to First Chinese Baptist in Houston. And a great loss for us because all of our ministers, they don't just work in their area. They work across the board. All of them come with multicultural skills and multicultural sensitivity. We don't hire anybody just to work with black or anybody just to work with, you know, Chinese. We do have a Korean mission, which we had to start because of the language issue, and we hired someone there who is Korean, but in the mother church, you have to have multicultural skills and sensitivity in order to work with everybody. We're not just in one area. Anybody else? All right, Doc, let me come back to you. I think that would fit into the category of potential. You know, what can I do? And those, it used to be that there was a glass ceiling. And I would say this, and I'm not saying that that glass ceiling does not exist to some extent, but I see that glass ceiling coming back more and more. And I'm talking about within Southern Baptist life, where we're becoming much more inclusive. Our attitude is much more reaching out. Our boards are changing somewhat in color. Not fast, but slow. And that's where the real change is going to come. You have to have people on the boards who bring in folk like myself and T. Vaughn to work within the institutions. But I do see the what can we become. We don't have to just say, well, I'll be this and I'll be this in a certain race area, culture area. I think that the sky's the limit. And don't you set the place, though. I think that when you give it to God and you say, Lord, here's this life, I'm continuing, I'm a lifelong learner, I'm getting myself ready not only just to be a black pastor, a white pastor, or an Asian pastor, but Lord, you put me anywhere, and I promise you something. I'll be like your love in a vase. And when you pour me out, if you pour me out on whatever, I promise you I'm going to give a cup of water to somebody who's thirsty that hopefully can receive some new life in Jesus Christ. Thank you for having me.